As educators, we helped our students navigate the challenges, trauma, and disruption caused by the pandemic. All our lives were thrown off course, but our students were especially vulnerable. Lacking the social and emotional skills to navigate such a life-altering series of events happening all around them, it's reasonable that academic growth and achievement would dip because of a crisis of that scale. But as we approach 4 years since the onset of the pandemic, merely talking about the daunting recovery ahead of us won't do. It's time to use our skills as educators and problem solvers to act.
And with that inspirational, forward-thinking message, thank you, Jacob. Today's guest, I get to introduce one of my favorite people at NWEA, a researcher and author whose latest study captured ways teachers, real teachers, are leading the academic recovery effort and producing above-average academic growth, not achievement, growth, over multiple years for kids across the achievement spectrum.
We're happy to be joined by Dr. Chase Nordengrim, Principal Research Lead for Effective Instructional Strategies at NWEA. Chase works closely with leading scholars from around the globe to turn theory into actionable practices to drive instructional improvement. He's also the author of Step Into Student Goal Setting, A Path to Growth, Motivation, and Agency, published by Corwin Press and NWEA. But in addition to a bevy of accomplishments and expertise, Chase is a thoughtful, curious guy using his knowledge and know-how to help educators meet this moment head on. Thanks for joining us today, Chase.
Thanks for having me.
Chase, before we get started in asking you some questions, I would love for you to just lay the groundwork for the research that you've been a part of, been literally on the front lines for. Where did it come from and where are we now?
Yeah, so this work started a couple of years ago with a colleague of ours named Dr. Andy Hagedis, who was able to uncover by looking at map growth data. We, of course, have an extensive database of years of data for thousands of schools. Uncover this group of schools that, while they may not be notable in terms of the level of achievement they're hitting, are hitting consistently high growth for all different kinds of learners multiple years in a row. He was very adamant that there was something important to be learned from those schools about what they were able to do for their students. And so in my stage of the work, we actually visited two of those schools in a district in Illinois. They're schools that have achieved growth for students across the achievement spectrum for 7 years running. And we tried to figure out what it is that they were doing differently, that we could talk to our partners into the broader field about to help them understand what are the instructional practices that lead to being one of these high growth schools.
Did you have, as you were going into that, Chase, initial thoughts or anticipation about what you might find? I know, we talk about you being a curious guy. You are. What were you expecting to find?
Well, I think what we did know going in is the kinds of impacts that the pandemic had had across schools around the country. We knew from work NWEA has done, from work the other organizations have done, from what we'd heard anecdotally, that students were entering a given grade level with a wider variety of experiences than ever before. We expected, and our hunch was that schools that had always focused on promoting this high level of student growth, on meeting students where they were and trying to help them progress regardless, would have some innovative strategies for how to deal with that new reality. And certainly what we found is they're experiencing the same challenges that other schools are experiencing with the same kind of constraints, but applying those lessons that they had from the past in new ways to help deal with those new realities.
I mean, in fact, the school district, Schiller Park in Illinois, is facing, they were spending, the white paper that you wrote said that they were spending $2,000 less on average per student than the average Illinois school. So it's not like they had all of these resources. Their population was 55% non-white, 62% free and reduced lunch, and 25% English language learners. So it's not like this school, this is a plot of a movie, right? Where we've got a school that's got the deck a little bit stacked and they don't have any like extra money that they're throwing at their students. So when you were IDing this as a high growth school, you could have singled out the leadership of the school, the environment of the school, the curriculum of the school, but you chose to focus on what's the secret sauce in their instruction. So why did you choose to focus your attention on effective instruction?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there's a lot of fantastic work that has been done on effective educational leadership practices, on what a rigorous and high quality curriculum looks like. I feel like what's been underemphasized in a lot of that work is how students experience their day-to-day classroom environment. You know, at the end of the day, principals are incredibly important, resources are incredibly important, but what a student experiences is that relationship with their teacher and a relationship with that academic content. And so what we really wanted to get inside with this project is how are teachers teaching differently so that students can learn differently.
Chase, I want to, that's really interesting. I want to come back to that in a second, but just context setting for those that, you know, haven't read the research paper, which we'll link in our show notes for this episode. What do you mean when you say a high growth school or system? What are you actually saying there? What determines that?
Sure. Kaylee emphasized this in the introduction, so I think it's good to come back to. You know, when we're measuring achievement, we are measuring how a student is performing relative to other students at their grade level or at their age. When we measure growth, we're measuring the amount a student has learned. So regardless of where you come into school with from the fall, whether you're on grade level, whether you're two grade levels behind, whether you're two grade levels above, growth is a measure of how much you've learned during that time. And we wanted to focus on academic growth because we think there is value to be found in not just the schools that are successful at getting students who are just below grade level to just on grade level, but the schools that are successful on moving all different kinds of learning, regardless of where a student comes into the year.
Great. So what did you learn working so closely with them? What were you surprised to discover?
There's three major categories of practices that we talk about in the paper. They are, you know, in short, that high growth teachers are, first of all, maximizing students' time by finding a lot of innovative ways to make sure they're getting exactly the learning that they need. Second, that they're exposing students to more and a wider variety of content so that they can get kind of the best sampling of both on grade level and off grade level content. And that finally, they're finding ways to empower students by giving them the kinds of activities that lead them into deeper level thinking. I think the most surprising finding in there is just how much, you know, across grade levels had in common. Obviously, this looks, it looks different when you're doing this in first grade versus when you're doing it in seventh grade. But we were able to identify for each of the 10 strategies, versions of that strategy that worked for students of all ages and at all experience levels. And so I think as much as we need to focus on and the things that teachers need to specialize in at each grade level, there's also a lot of lessons that we can take across grade levels that can work for a variety of kids.
Okay, so Chase, you said that the three things that you, the kind of three umbrellas that you noticed are teachers are optimizing students' time, exposing students to more content, and empowering their students to drive the learning more, elite more, just more. And one of my favorite resources that we'll link in the show notes includes like 10 specific instructional strategies that fall under those three umbrellas. But I wanted to ask you, maybe put you on the spot for an example of a strategy that that you observed. Maybe it's anecdotal. I know you literally worked in teachers' classrooms, got close to the teachers and maybe even their students. But how maybe applying what you saw this teacher doing, no matter their grade level or no matter the subject that they were interacting with, but how any teacher in any classroom could implement that strategy.
Yeah. One of the strategies, just to borrow an example, is kind of this mixing of whole group, small group, and individual activities. So one of the things that we found is that these teachers at a variety of grade levels structured their lessons in such a way that students got both the opportunity to work as a whole class on a particular learning area, but also work in small groups on particular challenges and sometimes even individually. That looks a little bit different from kind of the elementary school side to the middle school side. What you often see in elementary school is the use of instructional technologies to do things like reading workshops and writing workshops where students zero in on a particular piece of learning based on where they've been assessed in the past. But because students become familiar with that structure and that way of doing things in younger grades, by the time they get into middle grades, they're a lot more experienced with it. And so when you get into the kinds of project-based learning that middle grades teachers especially want to get students involved in, what I think we found is that they're ready to just kind of hop right into it. And it can accelerate all the way to the point where one of the classrooms that we worked with is a completely self-directed math classroom where students spend most of the period working in small groups or individually on particular math problems based on their current levels. And they are the ones who are driving the experience and making choices about what content to work on and when it's time to move on to the next thing.
That's so cool because it explains a little bit more why there might have been 6 years of this, because it was the same kids mostly in the district learning how to work together. That's really cool.
And Chase, that kind of, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, that sounds like that is a strategy that, or a practice that educators put in place that kind of hits all those themes. Would you agree? Instructional time, content, and empowerment?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the big takeaways here is not getting so much caught up in trying to name and put into a box every single one of the strategies, right? There's opportunities for a variety of implementations that fit student needs, that fit kind of teachers' areas of focus, what they're good at, their personalities. We really wanted to use these 10 strategies as 10 examples of what this kind of instruction could look like as kind of inspirational starting points for readers to start to think about how can I make this work in my classroom? And what can I do that can help check some of these boxes?
You know, Chase, I just want to follow up. That's wonderful. You think about a system making this kind of reliable growth and outcomes for kids. There must have been a lot of calibration, collective efficacy amongst the educators by design. You talk about differences from grade level, but even within grade levels, for kids to have a similar experience, as Kaylee says, over 6 years, for example. What did that look like? How did a system or a group of teachers work or develop that practice? Do you have insights from the research?
Yeah, I think this is where that leadership component really starts to come in. So the first, you know, really important thing to say about leadership is that there are a lot of barriers in a lot of traditional schools that need to be knocked down to make this work successfully. Teachers need access to the kinds of curricular resources that allow them to put a different activity with a bunch of small groups of students. They need the freedom that lets them kind of not work from a script and make those adjustments on the fly. The second big leadership component that I think contributed to building this culture was that leaders were very intentional about kind of spreading their culture leaders around. So where maybe a practice like this incubated at a particular grade level with a particular group of grade level teachers, the following year, those teachers spread around and they start to evangelize the same set of approaches to other grade levels. And you can see how, you know, you undertake that process for several years and they start to take root and become a more kind of organic part of the culture.
Well, that's amazing. And it makes me, like crave that kind of professional development that's like peer to peer. And Jacob, I know that as our professional learning dude, guru guy, that you're like, yeah, let's get more of that. Like just the art of teaching each other as we teach our kids. Well, and Chase, as teachers who are listening to this and getting inspired by it and are like, I want to do something tomorrow. What can I do tomorrow? Like one little thing that kind of might capture, I guess, those three umbrellas, if you see them as a Venn diagram, are examples or just things that you would put in the places where they overlap. There's more there, but 10 of them we have written out. What's a strategy that a teacher could maybe turn around after they listen to this podcast and go implement?
Yeah, you know, I think any of the 10 strategies are ones that hopefully provide a good starting point. What I might, you know, suggest today, one of the things we noticed, and it's documented in one of the strategies, is the use of teachers sharing students between classrooms, whether it was a full-on co-teaching model where two teachers were in the same classroom working with different groups of students at the same time, or whether it was something more informal. And I think that kind of informal sharing between classrooms is something that could happen a lot more, even in environments where there is not a kind of formalized structure around it. So I'd say as a first step, you know, visit another teacher at your grade and talk about whether there is value in sharing your students with each other and what you could accomplish if you could do that. I think the big thing that we found is, you know, if one teacher is capable of managing two or three groups of students who are working on different things, then two teachers are potentially capable of managing four or six. And that additional level of support means even more targeted instruction based on where students are and what they're ready to learn next.
That's great. Just so appreciate your digging into the research, the work, the schools, carrying forward Dr. Andy Hegedus's work to bring these kind of insights to partners. Product placement warning for our listeners. Look, Schiller Park uses Map Growth, also obviously the sponsor of this podcast. They use it as their interim assessment. But I want to be clear, is that necessary for implementing these strategies, Chase?
I don't think it's necessary. What I will say is we heard from teachers that there were a lot of advantages to having that just-in-time assessment of where students were and what they were ready to learn next. So having access to assessment information right away in week one in the fall was what allowed them to, you know, start thinking about where are the right places to group students, what are the right pieces of content to focus on, what can I do with this group. At the same time, they were all very conscious of the fact that you can't rely on a single assessment to get that kind of information. And as students progress throughout the months to follow, a variety of formative assessment practices were used by these teachers to really get inside what students were learning in real time and make those adjustments so that students weren't stuck in a particular mode of learning, weren't stuck focusing in the same areas over and over again. So in short, you know, whatever assessment system you have, what's important is collecting different kinds of data early and often so that you are really keeping tabs on what have students learned in the last month, in the last week, and what can I do with that information to put them in a good place moving forward.
That's great, Chase. I really, really appreciate that. You know, one more question from me. You know, you've kind of picked up the torch from Dr. Andy Hegedus kind of taken us to the next chapter of High Growth for All. Let's think about it in the, you know, if you watch Marvel, right, the cinematic universe of High Growth for All. What's next? What other elements of high growth schools or systems do you hope NWEA digs into and continues this great body of work as we look forward?
Yeah, so there's a lot of great opportunities moving forward. I think the biggest one has to do with some of the findings that we've started to see in the research on cognitive and learning science. So we have, and I think the British especially, have been really good at looking at the research that's gone on in cognitive psychology and neuroscience about how people learn generally and applying that work to schools. There are a lot of echoes, a lot of resonant points between that work and some of the things we found in the Transformative 10. What I think is incumbent upon us now is finding a way to take those echoes and amplify them so that we are using more work with teachers who are making this kind of learning happen to make clear connections between the kinds of instructional strategies that we've been focused on for years and all of that new learning about how the brain works and how best to capture and keep students' attention.
Man, Chase, that's, I mean, right. Way to be like a teaser trailer for that. Right. should we just keep talking about that? That sounds amazing. Yeah. Oh my gosh, we are both obsessed with you. Jacob and I are so obsessed with Dr. Chase Nordengren. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being our guest. Fangirls over here. We will include links to Chase's paper and the High Growth for All web experience, like so you can watch the videos, meet the Schiller Park people, and then hear those 10 strategies, especially if you're an educator who wants to get started. Guys, if you enjoy this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to help us reach more educators on their professional growth journeys, on their commutes, as they look for some encouragement and some inspiration. Thank you again for listening to The Continuing Educator and for all you do to help kids learn and grow. We'll see you next time.